This is October 24th in the year 2000, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing Hilliard Caldwell at his home at 1235 Hillsborough Road in Carrboro.
Good morning, Hilliard.
Hey, how's it going today?
I'm doing great. And yourself?
Fine, thank you.
I would like to go back over the events surrounding the integration of Chapel Hill High School. And I'll start with this question. What actions were there in the black community to have the schools integrated, and specifically the high school, if you can focus on that, if not just in general the school system?
Well, I think the black community at that time most certainly felt that that the all-black schools were most certainly inadequately from a standpoint of buildings, equipment, books, supplies, and it was always the thinking of our community that all of the new and good stuff went to the white schools, and secondhand equipment and books came to the black schools, and that it was the norm. I think as we got into the early 60s, as we finished out the 50s, the thinking in our community began to focus on, you know, why can't we just have one school in the community? And we know we can't have one elementary school because the town is too large for that. It would need to be two or three. Even in the elementary schools, you could somehow devise an attendance plan to give racial balance in the schools. And as we approached the 60s, there were some individuals who, as a result of the Freedom of Choice plan that the school board instituted in the early 60s, who chose to apply to go to the white high school down on Franklin Street. And there were some brave souls who did that, and was in, it was no more than 5 or 10, as I can recall, might not even been 5, who decided, well, we want to go to this school down on Franklin Street. And they applied under the Freedom of Choice plan to go there and was accepted. I know some did graduate with the all-white senior class there during the early days. And as I said previously, it was the board's foresight to not have to go through federal mandated school integration, and somewhere between the early 60s and 65 or 66, decided to it was feasible to build one big high school out on where you had enough land to expand, and that was the creation of the present Chapel Hill High School out on Homestead Road today.
Was there a board of education that was for the white schools and a board for the black schools?
No, it was one board of education, one superintendent. And of course, it was back in those days, it was predominantly white school board.
Was it all white?
All white up until J.R. Manley became the first African American to be elected to the Chapel Hill Carrboro School Board. And I might say was a fine member of that board, representing his community very well during those early years. I can't remember the exact year that he became a member of the board. He would be another good choice for an interview as the first African American on the Chapel Hill Carver School Board.
Jerome Manley?
Yeah. Yes.
How many were on the school board?
Well, you know, the boards had to be an odd number to give to break a tie. So I think there were 7 members, as I can recall.
So I take it from what you said that there was good support in the African American community for the.
With some apprehension, I failed to mention, with some apprehension, because anytime you decide to bring two unknowns together, you're going to have some apprehension on both sides. And of course, we were concerned with getting a good education, a decent education, and I'm sure that the white community had some misgivings about it also. And then there were those who felt that it was the best thing in the world to do was to integrate the school system so that we all can be educated at the same time under the same system, for a better direction, for a better description of what I'm trying to say. Now, I still believe that our educational process from a segregated standpoint was the best that it could be at that particular time. We have many, many outstanding citizens today who were product of that, including myself, who went on to become doctors, lawyers, politicians, myself. And as I look back over the days, sitting in an all-black classroom, I felt there was a sense of really, really wanting me to learn from that teacher that was standing in front of the classroom. Her heart was in preparing me and the others for life at that to meet society. And at that particular time, it was rough and hard, in a segregated society.
Was your teacher your role model?
Guys like R.D. Smith, whom you will be talking to later, was a role model. My late principal, Mr. C.A. McDougall, was a role model, because they always instill in us, we know we don't have the best over here, but make the best of what you've got. We know we don't have good furniture. We know we don't have the best of a chemistry lab. We know we don't have... We know we get to use books from the white high school. Take the advantage of that book, and go on and make the best of it. I questioned that every day I was in school during the segregated eras with my administrator, with the principal, with R.D. Smith. And they would always say, son, it's not much we can do about the system today, but just take the advantage of what we've got here.
Was there an organization or a political group that was pushing for integration in the African American community?
To my knowledge, I don't think there was an organized effort until the early 60s, when the groups you read about or will read about in the book, The Free Men, by John Ely, when groups start forming because of not school segregation, but segregation in businesses, where we put a lot of economic power in, yet we weren't getting anything out of it. For example, the drugstore was one of the main focuses of the early struggle in our community, because it was the drugstore closest to the Afro-American community. Therefore, we went there for all our drug needs and all our needs from a store like a drugstore. And there was a lunch counter, and we could buy sandwiches and drinks, but we had to buy them and leave. We couldn't buy them and sit down. So the only organization that I can remember was the early 60s, when the young people felt that it was time to make a change in places like eatery, the theaters, restaurants.
Was there any kind, let me phrase it differently, was there a dialogue between the white and the black community regarding the integration of the high school?
I can't recall any. And as I said previously, that was one of the reasons we had the turmoil at the high school. Once they brought the kids together, there was no pre-planning to integrate on either side. Next thing we knew, we had a new building out there, and it was announced that all the students from Lincoln High School and all the students on Merritt Mill Road and all the students from Chapel Hill High on Franklin Street would, from 9th to 12th grade, would go out to a new Chapel Hill High School.
And all this planning was done by the board?
If there was any planning at all, I don't think there were any planning from the standpoint of faculty and students and parents. I think the only planning that the board was involved in was from a building standpoint and getting the building ready. Nothing, as I can recall, to my knowledge, and as I said, I joined the system in 69, 2 years after it integrated, after they built the high school. So I can't recall any planning to do this. Some of our faculty members lost their jobs, and some of the white high school lost their jobs. And there is one or two Afro-American faculty members who've since retired. That was part of that movement that went from our high school to the high school. And she most certainly, and Mrs. Battle, B-A-T-T-L-E, I have to give you a first name. But she's retired in the area now.
Who chose the teachers?
Well, I think your superintendent at that time. And I think, as I can recall, I think the superintendent depended on the two principals to assist him in selecting people to go. And of course, as I said, you know, everybody couldn't go to the new high school because you didn't need all those teachers. Some people went on to other, when this became, you know, the summer after school closed and then the next school year was going to be the new high school, I think a lot of those people just sought employment elsewhere in other systems. But those who were, you know, asked to stay or asked to go, you know, that was good for them to go on out to the new building.
What percentage of the students in the new school, do you have any idea, were black, and what percentage were white?
I think that percentage reflected the community percentage, about 70 white, about 30% Afro-American.
And was this represented in the teaching?
No, I can tell you that, for it was not representative of the faculty. It was not until many years later that the school board and the superintendent at the time felt that the population of the faculty ought to also reflect, it should be an outcome of a percentage of students to give it a more balanced outlook. You know, black students going into high school, and there's only two or three Afro-Americans on the faculty, and the other 70 are white. You know, that you would be uneasy too if that was something that you worried about, that you didn't have enough of your faculty members to go to if it was a problem.
It's interesting to hear you say that R.D. Smith, one of your teachers at Lincoln, took you under his wing, and that you felt that many of your teachers were there to see that you succeeded in life. Do you think that the same kind of philosophy, the same kind of thinking existed at the new high school for the African American students?
Not being part of that plan, having been an adult at the time that took place, I think I would be safe in saying that was not the case. Back during that time, and I think back during my time, teachers could spot leadership from the way they asked questions in their class. They could spot a leader, you know, how well he or she responded to questions, answered, how they participated in organizations, how they carried themselves. And I think that's what R.D. saw in me. And I was very poor, you know. I'm from a family of five brothers and a mom who was struggling to get us through high school. And my mom said, you know, carry yourself so that you make me look good as a parent. And as R.D. Smith would tell you, I had a chip on my shoulder. I felt everybody was against me because I didn't have all the nice clothes. I didn't have, you know, the finery things of life as some of my classmates had. I don't know whether I was feeling guilty about it, and I guess I was feeling guilty because if I had a chip on my shoulder. But R.D. saw that chip, and he told me one day, I want to knock that chip off, you know, and he did. And, excuse me. And as a result, I ended up in 1955 being elected president of my student body at an all-black high school. And that was an honor. I ran against a popular guy in the high school, who probably should have got elected but didn't, because people saw the new leadership in Hilliard College and what I stood for. And yeah, I was didn't have a lot of money in my pocket all the time like the guy that I ran against, didn't have the nice clothes, but students saw that he was somebody who was going to represent us well. And that was the beginning of my career to become a public figure in my community one day. And in 1980, I started that career and ended it up in 1999.
Your mother must have been very proud.
Well, she had died before all of that. But I felt that she was looking down on me.
Did you feel that there was an attempt by the white community to keep the blacks from being bused to the new integrated high school?
No, I don't. I can't recall that there was any effort to keep that from happening. People know that Chapel Hill was a very liberal, more or less, community, and I think it got that name as a result of people coming into the university from up north, who was very active in the community also.
I had heard that, and I had also heard that Lincoln High School was closed because the students were going to boycott the school and just end up at the new Chapel Hill High School. Is that just a rumor?
I think that was a rumor. It was a board's plan to eliminate the Lincoln High School as a high school and make one big high school in a community this size. I was really shocked when the board announced a couple of years ago they were going to build a new high school here. I didn't think I'd ever see two high schools in Chapel Hill, Carver community. And it is going beautiful facilities out there. Got a good leader. He chose a great faculty when they first opened. Still has that out there now.
Can you go back and review for me the problems that existed at the high school the first 2 years, and who handled these problems before you got there, and how they were handled?
Well, I think there was always some uneasiness out there. You know, black kids, white kids, they'd never been brought together before, there were those whites who felt that who had the thinking that all blacks were mean. There were those whites who took some of the black kids, became very dear friends. And then there were those whites who felt that the integration was okay, but the socialization was going to be the thing that bothered them with the black boys and the white girls, and the white girls and the black boys, you know. I think that was one of the main stumbling blocks for integration throughout these United States. It was the socialization that was going to take place once you brought young people together. And I'm convinced that had parents stayed out of that issue, other than from an advisory standpoint to their children, not taking on the role of Johnny, you're not going to be associated with him or her. And as a result, back in those days, a lot of private schools popped up all over the country, Christian academies here and there. I know one home up in there was Carver Christian Academy here. And I remember very well, after two or three years, and these academies started instituting some very stringent rules on the length of dresses and hair and all that kind of stuff. I remember I had a neighbor down the street here who came back to our system about two, 3 months after the school had opened and said, I'll never forget, they came up here and said, you know, can our daughter come back to the public schools? And I said, yes, there's no reason, you know, why she can't come. And they said, we just can't put up with the rules and regulations of Carver Christian Academy. And then they were teaching racial hatred as part of their routine. And she said, we want our child to grow up to respect human beings for who they are, not for the color of their skin. And if you look back over the history of academies throughout the South, that was one of the reasons a lot of them got set up, because these parents didn't want the socialization to take place of black and white.
I think the ultimate thing was the fear of intermarriage?
Oh, I think that was part of it. In the back of lots of people's minds, particularly whites.
Again, I'd like to go back over some of the, go back to that issue of some of the other problems One you mentioned was socialization. Were there fights?
There was always some fights. Nothing that was caused 15 or 20 people to go at each other. But you know, there were some isolated fights during the 2 or 3 years, the beginning of it, over petty stuff.
What other sorts of problems existed?
I think black kids said that, I remember complaints that the white teachers were not giving them due credit for the work they were doing in the classroom. That the teachers were harder on them than the white students. More blacks got sent out of the room than whites for petty issues. Black kids were told to, I remember, you know, hang in there. All this is gonna come to an end. You know, one day you're senior and you'll graduate and you'll go on out to whatever you want to do. And then there were those kids who couldn't take that kind of pressure, you know, white, black, together on both sides, you know. Because I remember I told you that we integrated the high school, just threw everybody together. And you know, there should have been there should have been seminars with faculty members, there should have been groups of students, should have, you know, the leaders from the black high school, student leaders should have been brought with the leaders of the white high school and sat down and worked out a peaceful existence as it would be at the new high school, you know, coming to some compromises to what the mascot was going to be, display our trophies like you're going to display yours, and then display cages and cases in the hallways, agree upon a color that was mutual to both sides instead of just accepting everything from the white high school. So remember, we also had trophies and school colors and school songs, school mascot.
Did they eventually get together?
They did. That all of this came about, you know, 3 or 4 years down the road later, and it was agreed that the Wildcat Lincoln High was Tigers, and I think they accepted one's mascot, the other one's color. I can't remember which one that they did do, but and once all of that got taken care of, things seemed to go, you know, on a smooth course. I know my from 72, I did about 3-4 years out there, a half a day as a regular 40-hour a week. And then gradually I was just used as they needed me on problems. They needed to get the thinking of somebody from the black community as it related to just, you know, some of the issues that was going on out there. But the two leaders, the two principals, as I look back over it now, I felt they did an admirable job of being thrown together, working as cohesiveness as they did, because they wanted it to work, just like, you know, a lot of other people wanted it to work. Mr. McDougal, Mrs. Marshbanks, were both from the old school from the standpoint of discipline and, you know, running their ship in an old-fashioned way. You respected the faculty. You, they didn't care for foolishness. And you did something that needed to go home for. You were sent home. That's the way it should have been. Mr. McDougal, the black principal, was stern. You dare not be caught in the halls between classes, because he knew you should have been in that room sitting down learning something. And for God's sakes, in my days, don't be in a hall without a book or notebook or pencil in your hand, or one that he could see anyway, you know. And I remember the both of them, and they became, I think, very good friends. you know, with each other.
You mentioned the relationship between the white teachers and the black students. What about the relationship between the black teachers and the white students? Were there any problems there?
One of the Afro-American teachers who were part of that could best answer that. She was right there on the scene. And I don't think I want to attempt to answer that specific question. I always assumed that it was a good relationship, because that black teacher had to be good to have been chosen to go there anyway. But see, Chapel Hill Schools, High School, prided itself on Morehead Scholars, National Honor Society, great numbers in my high school. From my perspective, I always felt that the white students highly respected the black teachers. I know R.D. Smith, whom hopefully you'll get a chance to interview, taught auto mechanics. And white kids just swarmed to take his course because he was the best. And some of his product today is right here in Chapel Hill with the Scroggs boy that runs the Mercedes place out on Airport Road, used to be in Palmer. Steve's, what's his name? He's got his brother Steve was principal of this school here. But Mr. Smith was his instructor for 4 years in auto mechanics. And boy, Mr. Smith used to have to turn down kids who wanted to take his class because they knew he was a damn good instructor when they came to auto mechanics.
About the relationship of the teachers, the black teachers, the white teachers. Would I be better asking Mrs. Battle about this, or were you privy to?
Well, no, I think, you know, them being there 7-8 hours a day, again, from the outside world, I always thought it was good. It was good rapport from what I could see. I was never in any of the faculty meetings because I would leave at 12 noon. Again, from what I can see, I thought they got along very well. You know, they were all part of the same family now, but of a different background. But when it came to teaching, I always felt that they were there to do what they were trained to do, and that was to teach.
I've heard some comments about the educational background and preparation of the vice principal versus the principal, Mr. McDougall versus Mrs. Marshbanks. I wonder if you would comment on that. I think the comment that I heard was in effect that Mr. McDougall was better prepared educationally to be principal. Was there any?
I can't recall any of that, those issues coming to the forefront, but I suspect Mr. McDougall was probably better prepared to be an administrator. Nothing against Miss Marshbank. She was a beautiful person, had a beautiful personality. She always respected me and my thinking on issues. I can't recall that ever being an issue that was outright publicly. But I think in a lot of people's back of mind that Mr. McDougall, and remember, he was a black principal who operated under the most adverse conditions in educating Afro-American students in the community. You know, and everybody else know, that Lincoln High School was most certainly inferior as it compared to Chapel Hill High School. That was a given. But again, Mr. McDougall relied on the community, the PTA, parents, band uniforms. School board, I can't recall them buying uniforms for our band. We had band drives, we had uniform drives, we had football drives to buy football equipment. As I can remember, some of our football equipment came from Carolina. Our football coach back in those days was always friends to the coach of the team, the coach at Carolina. And those guys would donate stuff from their program to. And a lot of whites love to come out. to watch Lincoln High School football players play at the old Lions Park out in Cardinal back in those days. I remember a large crowd of whites would come out every Thursday night or might be Friday night to see them play.
I understand they won a number of
state. I remember one year as an adult, I can't remember the team, but the guy named W.D. Pierman, whom the Chapel High Stadium was just named for the other night, a group of us Booster Club members got together, raised money to take the football team from Lincoln High to see a professional game in Washington way back. And I'll never forget the weekend we went up there. It was the coldest I'd ever been in D.C. I mean, that stadium was cold as hell. But we chartered a bus, paid for the fares, we went up, watched the game, and got back on the bus and came back home. We didn't even spend the night. But it was a sort of a gift to the football team for them to see a professional Washington Redskins and somebody else play in a stadium up there.
What about the extracurricular activities, sports, band, clubs, in the new integrated high school? Did the African-American students join in?
There were a few. And remember, as I said earlier, Lincoln High had a top marching band because we always had a damn good music teacher who took pride in his work in creating a beautiful marching, performing band. The football teams at Lincoln High, basketball teams, were always state champions in their district, in their league from a state standpoint. We were double A school back in those days. A few kids played in the band, and as the years went by, more and more became band members. But a lot of them, I think, gave up the idea of doing music in the band for whatever reason. And we just didn't have a large number from that point on. I don't know what it is today out there.
So the enthusiasm for being members of the football team or the basketball team, that seemed to drop?
It dwindled. There would be one or two here and there. And I think it got better as integration became a given. I know my son, when he went through middle school, well, it was junior high in those days, there was always a good number of blacks who made the team. As I can remember now, there were more blacks on the team than those whites who made it. And it was the black guys who were very athletically gifted, a better word. And looked like that just got better and better as the years went by. And even at the high school with the football team, basketball team. That's where you'd find the largest number of Afro-Americans on a football team and a basketball team. Didn't find too many of us coming out with baseball or tennis. Tennis every now and then, one or two. I know we had Junior's son who was on the tennis team. Can't remember any other guys. But there's a little boy who came through the school system named A.J. Jackson. I don't know where he is or what he's doing. I remember he was going out to a tennis school up in the mountains up in Hendersonville for a while. And all of a sudden, I know his mom and dad was here for two or three years. And all of a sudden, I just lost track of AJ. I got to find out what's happened to AJ.
I always wondered about it until I saw him play at the tennis club tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Very, he's going to. I thought he'd make it to the pro circuit.
I don't know what happened.
Wasn't his father a baseball player also?
I know his father played ball, and I know he worked at the Ratskeller or one of those Danziger's places during his time here.
Well, another question for you, and that is, how is it that you got hired? Who made the decision?
That's an interesting story. dear friend of mine, a guy named Ed Tenney, who still lives here now, down off in Tenney Circle, off in Franklin Street, was a member of the school board, and he was a Republican by political affiliation. Ed called me one day, and I was on the staff at the Department of Medicine, at the School of Medicine. Ed called me one day during the budget session of the school system and said, Hilliard, he said, we've just voted to create a new position in the school system called homeschool coordinator. And what we're interested in is having somebody work out at Lincoln Center that the community, and particularly the Afro-American community, could call on the problems that they had at their particular school. And we're going to make this position a position directly under the superintendent control, and that and you would troubleshoot for him, carry out any assignments he needs you to do or want you to do. And there are three of us on the board who feel that you, from your experience and your involvement in community affairs as a community activist, would be ideal. And I said, me? He said, yes. He said, I represent two other school board members. And he said, so I need to report back that I've called you and that you go in and apply for the position. So I came out home that evening and told my wife, and I said, well, it would give me Monday through Fridays. I wouldn't have to do any Saturdays or Sundays work, and that would be a plus for me. So I did. I applied. The superintendent at that time was a guy named Bill Cody, who just recently gave up the position of state superintendent of schools in the state of Kentucky. I know the dean of the School of Education at Central applied for the position. But what they did in Kentucky, the governor appointed the second in command under Cody. She was an insider, I think, who got the job as state superintendent of state schools in Kentucky. But Bill Cody was a fine man. I went, got an application, had two interviews. Third interview, they called me back for a third interview, and I said, yeah, what's going on? I said, well, you know, you've got some qualities that we like, and we want to explore them. And I had the third interview. The next thing I got in the mail was an offer letter offering me the position. And I accepted. Start working August of 69 and finished up in July of 91. Very great career for me. Worked under five or six superintendents. My position had to be voted on each year. I never worried about getting contract renewed. Because, you know, I cared myself so that there'd be no questions about whether I should be rehired or not from anyone. Had a good community record. Community people were very impressed with how I handled things in the community as it relate to the school and the community. Say a teacher was having trouble getting a parent in for a conference. Mind you, they would refer that to me. My job would be to go and convince that parent or parents come in for the conference, and I never failed. I always got that person in for conference. PTA involvement in 69 was very low from the Afro-American community. I worked very hard to increase that number from 3 or 4% attendance at PTA meetings up to 70 and 80%. I concentrated on that, made transportations available to the parents, convinced the PTAs of all six schools at that time to give me a little bit of their PTA monies so that I could have a fund to contract transportation, to buy clothing, to handle, to solve social ills as it came to our attention. Kid needed shoes. He was out. Didn't go to school because he didn't have any shoes. And I solved that problem by creating a count at Belts at that particular time. And Johnny needed shoes. I'd take him to Belts, gave him the satisfaction of selecting his own shoes within a reasonable price. Belts worked very closely with him with shoes and clothing. Kids who having trouble seeing, and we felt the school nurse felt that they needing an eye exam, worked out a plan with the Hale brothers, who had been at the hospital and then went out into private practice, and they allowed me to, they did my exams for me, free of charge as a service to the community. Eyeglasses, worked with the Eckert's Optical at that time for a long, many years at a discount. Physicals, kid needed the physical, we wanted to know what was going on, why he was sleeping so much in class. A good example, lesson example. Bob Senior at that time was a pediatrician, worked very closely with me. You know, I created these programs or the contact, and they were grateful to me, grateful in helping us. And I'll never forget that. Even today, parents call me thinking I'm still working, and I said, I'm sorry, but I'm no longer employed. And I'm told, in fact, just recently, I had about 5 or 6 parents to tell me. And also rode shotgun, as an old saying, over attendance. If a kid was out of school 10 days and nobody knew why, no report from home as to why Johnny is not in school, then that would come up to me at Lincoln, and I'd get right on it, home visit, find out, you know, what the problem, if it was a health problem, document it, get documentation from the parent that he was under the care of a doctor or had surgery or was hurt, you know, and then report it back to the school. And if it was pure negligent, then my job was to, I made the decision to take it into court. And I handled all of those cases.
It's a very clever and compassionate program.
Mm-hmm. And when I left in 91, they chose not to replace the position. So I don't know what they did with the appropriations.
What do you think were the major events or factors that led to a rapprochement between the African American and the white student body, or that's not phrased right. What was it that made the African American community feel at peace with what was going on in the high school and made them feel it was their high school?
I think it took them a long time to realize it was their high school also. It didn't happen first, second, third year of integration. I think later on down, as more minority teachers would be involved into the faculty, more involvement in the PTA. One of the things that I failed to mention, from a PTA standpoint, a lot of times when blacks got involved in PTA, everything was already set by the white parents. And Afro-Americans was not dumb to that. They knew that was the exact case. I think later on, PTAs and schools began to involve them from the ground level so that they would have a feeling that I was part of this, whatever the situation is.
Had some ownership.
Had some ownership in the originality of it, not bringing me in when everything's already set. For example, officers in the PTA. By the time Afro-Americans got to the first PTA meeting, all this was done. The leadership of the PTA was already there. Let me give you an example of how we worked this thing in Conborough. My son went to Conborough Elementary. Conborough was considered a racist school by a large number of people in the community because it was in Conborough. But when my son entered the fourth grade, I was asked by the leadership of the PTA at that time to be a candidate for president for the Conborough PTA. I agreed, got elected by the PTA body, and served, was very active until my son finished up. I think he was a fourth grader, and I served 2 terms as president. And good cooperation from the parents of the Conborough school. Principal and I had an excellent relationship, and I know when I came on board, there was no money in the PTA treasurer at the school. We had 2 or 3 funding raising. I knew the first year we did a barbecue sale, company down in Smithfield, and sold every bit of that barbecue we had ordered. People came out, never forget the evening we had to sit up. When I left the position as president of PTA, we had $1,200 in the treasury. And Conqueror really worked hard to make their PTA program work from an all-race standpoint.
Was there resistance to your taking funds from the PTA to solve the students and solve problems at the high school?
And the high school was part of my program, too, not just the elementary grades, where we found a lot of the problems, social problems. But I was surprised. There was a